then you have the politics of it, the idea that law is complicit in shaping power and hierarchies in society, right? So those are sort of the defining characteristics of critical legal studies. And you can see, even just as I speak about them, I hope, how applicable they are to intellectual property, which sometimes just strikes me as, like, most obviously a pure fabrication of law, right? Like a pure legal construction where we just think about, you know, what if we imagine that we could call this thing property and then we just make it up, right? And then we make up the law and then we say, this is so, right? And we expect people to believe it, and they do.
Hello there, Waffleistas.
Hello, you're listening to Copyright Waffle, the podcast that brings you a nice cup of copyright enlightenment with a slice of cake.
My name's Chris Morrison.
And my name's Jane Secker.
And we're a couple of self-confessed copyright geeks, and we run the website copyrightliteracy.org. We're on a mission to make learning about copyright fun, engaging and empowering.
And we're your hosts for Copyright Waffle, an archive of amazing chats with copyright experts and interesting people whose lives have been touched by copyright. Now, it has been some time since we recorded this podcast.
Yep.
It was actually recorded back in December of 2022. But our guest in this episode is the fantastic Professor Caris Craig. She's at Osgoode Hall Law School at the University of York in Canada. And she's currently the director of IP Osgoode, which is their intellectual property, law and technology program. She's also served as their associate dean for research and institutional relations.
So in our conversation, we discuss her copyright history, how she ended up getting to where she is by being in the right place at the right time. We talk about critical legal studies and how copyright law is not neutral. We talk about the history of copyright litigation in Canadian universities and, of course, her favourite cake.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So we did catch up with Caris for a bit of an update on what she's up to recently in April here, 2024. We also were able to share a musical treat with her. So hang on until the end of this podcast for some extra bonus content. But for now, let's get on and hear our waffle with Professor Caris Craig. Copyright Waffle, all right. Welcome to Copyright Waffle, Caris.
Thank you, Chris. Thanks, Jane. It's great to be here.
It's brilliant to have you. We've been following your work for a while.
We have, yeah.
And we were just earlier this week caught a lecture of yours. We'll talk about all that stuff later on. But yeah, it's great to talk to you and welcoming you to the podcast.
Thank
you so much for joining us. I think we first met you. You joined us for one of our webinars when we were looking at the paper you'd written with Bob Tarantino about copyright in a time of crisis and some of the experiences that were going on in Canada that mirrored quite a lot, I think, of our experiences of supporting copyright during the pandemic.
Yeah, I remember that. And I remember Bob saying to me after, they're adorable, they should have a podcast. And here we are.
And here we are. The circle has come full circle and joined round the back, or something along those lines. Can we start, Caris, by asking you about how you got involved in copyright in the first place? What's your copyright history?
I came to Canada, where I am now, on exchange from the University of Edinburgh, and I took an IP class when I got to McGill, and I didn't do very well in it.
Okay.
I didn't even really like it very much. Right. But I wanted to stick around for the summer when I finished my exchange year, and I got a research assistant position with David Lametti, who is now known maybe to some as the Minister of Justice in Canada. Mm. So, you know, his career took off.
Okay.
But at that time, he was just a new professor at McGill. And because he did property theory, he was tasked with teaching the intellectual property course. And as a new professor, when you're asked to teach a course, you just have to agree to do it. But he wasn't necessarily particularly excited about having to teach IP. When I had done legal theory with him and then said I was doing IP, he asked if I would work with him over the summer to put together his IP course. But it had to have this theoretical angle because that was his thing.
Right.
So I spent all summer. And this is going back, I don't want to age myself too much, but this was...
a few years.
This was last century. So so it was just, you know, early days for the internet and for sort of digital technologies. When I did that work, I was still sitting cross-legged in front of the case citators in the library, trying to piece together things and photocopy them and physically make a book of materials. So that dates it. But basically, that was when I started reading all of this literature on intellectual property theory and bringing this sort of work I was doing on jurisprudence and critical theory to thinking about IP. And I was blown away by the stuff I was reading. And it's sort of the Peter Yazzie, Jamie Boyle, Jessica Littman, Wendy Gordon, Justin Hughes, all of the sort of initial thinkers and writers about IP, just at the time when internet technologies were challenging old sort of constructs of copyright in the online environment. And I loved it, right? So it was a really rich summer of reading. And then when I got back to Edinburgh, I had to finish off my LLB and I was doing some more like philosophy of law stuff there. I got to the end, I got a traineeship in Glasgow. I was supposed to become a corporate lawyer in Glasgow. And I don't know, I applied.
I can see the look on your face. I don't think you were destined for that, were you?
You don't know if that's the corporate law part or if it's the Glasgow part, because I'm actually from Edinburgh, so that's what I get on my face when I say Glasgow. No, but I applied to some master's programs in Canada to see if I might want to come back and extend my studies in Canada. And David Lametti was kind enough to write a reference for that and to help me think about what my thesis proposal would be. And it was kind of like at the very last minute, I got an invitation to come and do my master's at Queen's University. And I got a scholarship to do that that was actually bigger than what I was going to get paid to be training at a Glasgow law firm anyway. And so I decided to do that. And so I came back over and I did my master's thesis was on fair dealing and a comparative analysis of fair dealing in the UK and Canada and the US. And again, this was pre... like we'll talk a little bit more about developments in Canada probably, but it was before our big CCH case and before we started thinking about user rights and copyright balance in Canada. We were much more aligned at that point with the UK jurisprudence. Right. And so I was really arguing for a sort of US fair use approach for both Canada and for the UK at that time. And so that was like where I really started thinking about this. And then I went on and did my PhD at the University of Toronto. I was supervised in my master's by Dennis Magnusson, who had been driving through to Toronto 3 hours to teach their IP courses because David Vaver, who people might be aware of as well, had moved to Oxford at the time. And so there was no one to teach IP at Osgoode. And so when I did move to Toronto, Dennis Magnusson just said, listen, you don't need me to do this anymore. Caris Craig is going to be in Toronto, get her to do it.
Oh, wow.
Spare me the trouble. And so I started teaching quite early on in my PhD at U of T, and then I got hired at Osgoode in my second or third year of the PhD. And I've been teaching copyright law there ever since.
Ever since, wow. Mm-hmm.
So it's been a kind of case of you keep turning up places and people say, right, there's nobody doing this and you're the obvious person, so there you go.
You do this. I'm the only person.
Right.
No, it's one of those things. It's a combination, but a lot of luck, obviously, just because it was a time when there was suddenly this huge appetite to be thinking about law and technology and to be thinking about copyright in the online environment. We were getting close to the sort of peer-to-peer, not even, like the Napster file sharing crisis, like these kinds of things. And so there was a ton of attention on it, but you had really nobody in the academy who had been trained to think about this. I mean, there were a few people sprinkled across the country who had been doing work on intellectual property and copyright. But until that point, it had been really quite an arcane topic, you know, in sort of a corner of commercial law often, but not really a thing unto itself. And so there was this need, I think, for a sort of influx of people thinking about intellectual property and copyright specifically in this new context. And I happen to be in the right place at the right time and with the right people around me to encourage me. So it was great.
It's fantastic. I think quite a lot of what you do is sort of in the discipline of, I think, what they call critical legal studies. Mm-hmm. And I think we'd be quite interested in exploring a bit about the relationship that has with IP and copyright specifically. Chris and I have been talking a bit about what we called critical copyright literacy, but that kind of, you know, can you say a bit more about critical legal studies as a discipline?
So this is also something that was in the North American realm of legal scholarship. It began to take hold really in the 80s and the 90s, right? So again, when I first came over to North America, there had been maybe 10 to 20 years of excellent scholarship that was really critically thinking about law and the way that it works and the way that it makes itself real as a sort of tool of political power in our society. Yeah. And trying to sort of engage with law's reification and how we could deconstruct it to think about it in a more political way. Mm. And so, you know, that was really the sort of tide of legal theory at that time. And I had studied it a little at Edinburgh as well. Emilius Christodoulidis was my professor in legal theories of law and the person. And so he was very interested in this sort of a post-structuralist understanding of law in the world. So it was something that I love thinking about law that way, right? Not just as sort of the black letter, what you can learn, what the rules say, how it will be, not even just how it will be applied, but thinking about it as the thing that constructs our society in a way that shapes our norms, yeah, that shapes our interactions, that keeps us in our place sometimes, and thinking about how the law then can be a tool for change as well. Right. Mm. So that's the kind of legal theory thing. There's a few things that are sort of classic critical legal studies in this sort of US vein, that's thinking about law's sort of reification, right? The way it makes itself real, thinking about the law's indeterminacy, the way that actually it has these what seem like inscrutable concepts that actually are completely malleable and indeterminate and open to interpretation, right? And then the way that it mystifies itself, that it has this sort of legitimizing rhetoric that makes us think that it is real, that its logic is sort of inherent, but at the same time that it's incomprehensible to us, so we just have to sort of trust it. And then you have the politics of it, the idea that law is complicit in shaping power, yeah, and hierarchies in society, right? So those are sort of the defining characteristics of critical legal studies. And you can see, even just as I speak about them, I hope, how applicable they are to intellectual property, which sometimes just strikes me as like most obviously a pure fabrication of law, right? Like a pure legal construction where we just think about, you know, what if we imagine that we could call this thing property and then we just make it up, right? And then we make up the law and then we say, this is so.
Yes.
Right? And we expect people to believe it, and they do. And so I think, you know, that there's an obvious role for that critical theorizing.
Yeah.
When we think about IP. And then again, not a coincidence in terms of timing, that just as this sort of new group of scholars were emerging and writing about these new areas of law and the way they were being challenged by new technologies, it was in the context of the sort of rise of critical legal studies in US scholarship as well. So I actually think that some of those sort of defining scholars at the turn of the century thinking about IP really were coming at it with that critical angle from the beginning. And so IP scholarship is where we really see critical legal studies, I think, flourish and apply in a really almost tangible way to this area of law and policy.
One of the things that we saw you talk about recently was the work you've been doing based on the Create Evidence Wiki. So the Create, the research centre at Glasgow, pulled together this wiki database of evidence research into copyright law. And the whole event was about looking at the evidence that Create have managed to curate and pull together, and your topic was on gender, and you came up with some really interesting findings from what you've described as actually quite limited studies into the impact of intellectual property, or particularly copyright, on gender. And your starting point there is, it's obviously the intellectual property law, a centre of power, way in which these power structures manifest themselves. Clearly, it's not neutral.
Yeah.
You're still having to have those conversations with people that are saying, well, the law's just neutral. It doesn't say men can do this, but women can't. Nevertheless, it's clearly there are many aspects to how attributes like gender and people's identity do impact on how copyright law affects their behaviour.
Yeah, absolutely. I wrote a piece on critical theories of IP where I sort of charted, like, from that beginning that I was just describing, charted the sort of thread of critical theorizing through IP scholarship up to now. And this sort of parallels other trends in legal scholarship more broadly. But the critical perspective begins as sort of this political disruption, but often at the hands, certainly, of white men and Harvard scholars and so on initially. And then it kind of takes off because it lends you this sort of critical angle, which brings more voices into the conversation to say, well, once we start talking about the politics and power of the law in this context, then what we can see is the way in which theories of sort of originality and theories of intellectual worth, claims to knowledge and value, have been attributed to certain people in society, and those same sort of badges of value and originality have been denied to others who are marginalized or subordinated in our social and economic hierarchy. So we actually see a sort of growing trend of critical race theory being brought to bear in intellectual property law, feminist theories being brought to bear, theories of intersectionality, understanding the ways in which these sort of hierarchies and inequalities interact with one another and compound one another to exclude certain voices from the system and to reward and to prioritise certain kinds of creative contributions or creators to the detriment of others. And so, you know, once you see that, you can't unsee it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, wherever you look, you see that, you know, these concepts that I described as being so malleable and so political, these concepts end up being deployed in a way that, you know, that create and concretize privilege in certain places in societies.
Yeah.
And I was talking specifically about copyright and gender at the Create conference. And that was, as you said, Chris, like, that was looking or using the evidence that has been compiled in the Copyright Evidence Wiki at Create by the University of Glasgow folks. And that's really a tremendous, I think, sort of reservoir of knowledge for us to draw upon. When I was first asked if I would do a copyright and gender empirical evidence sort of summary for that, I was a wee bit sceptical about what I would find and how useful it would be. And, you know, I think one of the things I said at the talk that you were listening to was sometimes this kind of evidence is used to suggest that people need to be educated more about copyright and need to be brought into the intellectual property system to better exploit their rights and to enforce them against others. And so the sort of assumption that's behind that is that when people are not participating in the IP system, not enforcing their IP rights, not registering, not engaging, not threatening others, that that's just because they don't know enough. And I, you know, this is one of those areas where, like, I think we have to say, well, maybe people are actually choosing not to engage this way with other people. They're choosing not to understand their works and their creativity in this fashion as property for them to exploit and from which they want to exclude everybody else. And maybe that's not a failing on their part. Maybe that should tell us something about what the IP system is not doing well and should do or could do better.
hearing you say that, I'm reminded of the song from My Fair Lady, isn't it? Why can't a woman be more like a man?
You're going to do your Henry Higgins impression now. It's largely so he can take the mickey out of me because he calls me Eliza Doolittle.
I think we might need to at some point do a Henry Higgins.
Yeah, maybe.
But the thing that I'm also reminded of is a conversation at LILAC, the Information Literacy Conference that Jane was responsible for co-founding. But it was a talk similarly around gender differences in their responses to students' participation, I think, in seminars or something like that, or within the profession, the library profession, it may have been.
Okay.
And the conclusions they were reaching seemed to be more of the, what can we do to get women to do more of this kind of stuff? It's exactly the same point you're making. There's a system here, and maybe they don't want to, and maybe, maybe we shouldn't try to be...
There are some interesting differences. I think that you mentioned them as well earlier this week when you were talking at the event in Lisbon about women's behaviour. Women are less likely to infringe copyright, things like that. Can you say more about some of those kinds of things that you've noted?
Yeah, there were a few things. And again, like the number of studies are not overwhelming. And no. So, you know, there's more evidence that, you know, needs to be gathered to make sort of broad statements. But also there's nothing in it that's surprising or that really needs evidence to say. I mean, I think it all aligns with what we would assume anyway. So one of those things is that, like, when people are studying so-called piracy, and that was what, you know, a lot of the studies were on initially, in sort of music and software, and they were sort of industry oriented studies that were concerned about piracy, you know, because they were concerned about protecting profit. But what they found was that women just didn't engage in the same large-scale piracy as men did in many of the studies that they looked at, right? And so that was used at the time to say, okay, well, we want men to behave more like women. Right?
Yeah.
We want to educate them about how to be better people. And the assumption, of course, is that the infringing activity was sort of unethical or sort of criminal or criminal adjacent, at least. And so, you know, we know that men are just not as good as women.
Of course.
And so... So that's not surprising. But I think the thing that's actually interesting about that is that, if nothing else, it suggests at least that there's a kind of socialized respect for copyright and for the law of copyright that itself is gendered, right? Which in turn, you know, that suggests that women are restraining their activities in light of copyright limits and restrictions, or what they perceive to be copyright restrictions, more so than our men. So to the extent that we care that copyright limits our activities, it chills our expression, it stops us from engaging and sharing and accessing materials, then women are, in a sense, suffering those costs more than men, because they're restraining themselves more, right? So there's that. That was one of the takeaways, again, not super surprising, but worth thinking about. And then they showed, like, more of the smaller scale studies, so things that probably we can't really necessarily extrapolate from, but we can see patterns, is that when it comes to what women think is okay to do with copyright protected works, that they're much more attuned to things like attribution. Like, they tended in one study to think that copyright was more about unattributed copying and plagiarism than it is just about reproduction, right? So it was had more of an interpersonal dynamic. Like, is it wrong that you haven't acknowledged the person and their efforts? And if you have, then surely that's fine, right? Or else, you know, if you're just copying for entertainment purposes, then that's not great. But if you're engaged in a team project where you need this work, you need to access this work to complete your project, then that seems completely, or at least more acceptable to women than to men. So there's, you know, what it is that we think is wrong with copyright infringement seems a little bit different there as well, or a little bit gendered as well in its dynamics. And so that suggested one of the things we might say is that perhaps moral rights, which focus more on integrity and attribution, might resonate a little bit more with women than with men, than the sort of asking for permission to be able to make copies and going through sort of legal avenues or checking what you're right. But that seemed to be more congruent with the approach of men within this particular creative community that was surveyed. So just again, like, these differences in gendered responses to the law and to the norms norms of the law? Like, what are the social norms of the law that resonate? That seems to be gendered. And then, of course, you have on the other side the fact that you just have huge disparities in terms of what women get from copyright as opposed to what men get from copyright. So in the US, the register is a better indicator than elsewhere, perhaps because you still need to register works at least to enforce rights. So it's more of a common practice in the US. But what we see from studies of the register is that, you know, the number of women authors and creators or even copyright owners who appear on the register is far less than half, right? Like it's been, I think, historically 25-28%, up to maybe 38%. It's more for, I think, literary and dramatic works, but certainly for music and software, it's still very male in terms of who's on the register. So who's getting the benefits of copyright and enforcing their rights is still gendered. And then you have as well recent studies that have shown that, you know, women authors, even those who are participating in the copyright system, maybe registering their rights, whose job it is to create, are still getting paid a small share really of what men get paid to do the same work. So again, not surprising. You don't really need data to know that women are going to be underpaid for doing work of the same value. It's like that's across the board. But copyright is no exception to that. And in the pandemic, I think the recent study that Amy Thomas released from Create Again at the University of Glasgow showed that women's earnings had dropped really twice as much as men's in the same time over the last few years as a result of the pandemic too. And so you see, you know, just all of this, like not getting the benefits at the same time as paying greater costs for the copyright system. So for anyone that says, yeah, it's neutral, it's completely gender neutral because it treats everybody the same, is just looking at, you know, the law as it's written and not the way it's experienced by people in society.
Yeah, we were looking at that study this morning, actually, on our webinar, weren't we? The ALCS one about the earnings.
Amy Thomas, UK Authors Earnings and Contracts 2022, a survey of 60,000 writers, which we saw got picked up by The Guardian as well. So I think that qualifies as copyright news, doesn't it? So I'm just going to... So I thought I'd just play the copyright news.
Lovely.
The copyright news segment tends to be a little bit, because it takes us so long to edit the podcast, anything that we say, we don't want it to be too
timely. It's not that timely, is it? No. But there is an interesting discussion perhaps we could go on to, which is about the copyright situation in Canada and what's been happening with educational licensing in Canada.
Before we get on to that.
Oh, yes.
So I think there's a really interesting link here with what you've just said and the work that we've been doing talking to the library profession about their experiences of copyright. Mm-hmm. Because as we know, the library profession is predominantly
women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the role that they're often put into in their jobs is to be seen as a gatekeeper in, to some respects about copyright. Certainly, they are responsible for providing messages around copyright. And we know that that's been, I mean, there's been a lot happening in Canadian libraries, academic libraries, institutions. There's been a lot of legal action, and we are working as well with we're working on an exciting project with Amanda Wackerook and Celine Garrow Brennan from the University of Alberta. We're hoping to launch their copyright anxiety scale in the UK and to look specifically at the library profession and education and research communities to see what their experience of it is. Presumably you've seen a lot of this because you've been right at the coalface, haven't you, or the front line of some of these very robust discussions that have been happening in Canada.
Yeah, we have a terrific library community here that's very active on copyright issues, and we have several standout people who are really leading the charge, and Amanda certainly is one of them, and her work on the copyright anxiety scale has just been, I think it's a terrific way of thinking about these things that absolutely exemplifies everything we're just talking about.
Yeah.
You're right, you have, you know, you've got that gender dimension in terms of the profession already. That maybe a sort of socialized respect for the law and for copyright, that especially for people who love books and love authorship and love information, you know, like they sort of intuitively value that. And yet I think in people's professional lives, they are consistently disappointed by copyright law and by, you know, the limits that it places, the things they're allowed to do. And they're also tasked with communicating those rules to others, to the scholars, to the researchers, to the students who want to access the information. It must feel like an internal contradiction to be wanting to help people to access things because that's your job and that's why you do what you do, at the same time as it's your job to tell them that they can't or that you can't. You know, so that's, I think, a terrible position to be in. And I think it really is experienced at a kind of visceral level by a lot of people who work in libraries and educational institutions in that capacity. And so taking, you know, when we're talking about doing that kind of empirical research and doing studies and evaluating how people feel about copyright, how they respond to copyright, whether they obey and what they perceive to be the copyright laws, whether they understand that they have fair use rights and are fair dealing rights and how those can be exercised, I think that's really valuable research because it shows us how copyright works in the world, right? And then it also gives us this sense that it's not just what the law says, but it's how it's felt, it's how it's experienced, it's the stuff that it chills, it's the fear and the anxiety that it places on people's shoulders. I mean, these things are very real, and it's, I think, a terrible indictment of our copyright system that the people who most care, who most want to share, to read, to see authors thrive, are almost in the sort of political debates characterized as the enemies of authors and publishers. And it just is, you know, it's been kind of galvanizing to watch the library community in Canada begin to organize and to advocate. I think anything that we can do to support people in their roles and to make the copyright system work better for students, for educators, for researchers and for librarians is worth doing.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting because you've encapsulated the sort of emotion that is tied up with this space really well, actually. And we ran a survey of librarians about copyright, which didn't actually have that much space for qualitative comments, but we picked up in the couple of questions that there were that there was definitely something in there around copyright making people feel quite conflicted. And it led us to do a follow-up study. And I know that some people were sort of saying, oh, you know, this idea that it's causing anxiety and, you know, librarians are afraid of copyright is kind of, you're overplaying it. But I don't think we are. I think it is really quite genuine, as you say, that many librarians go into the field because they want to make information available. They perceive what they do as a public service, it's a public good. And then they get put in a situation where they feel very, very conflicted about, you know, who they should be best serving, that somehow, you know, in giving information to this researcher who's come in, are they somehow putting an author's livelihood at risk? They want to help people. They want to make information available.
Yeah.
It's a really real tension, I think, definitely.
I think it's very real. And, you know, it is interesting because we had, I wouldn't name names and actually they escaped me, but I was going to say that there was an op-ed published, I don't know, maybe a year or two now ago about libraries and how they were a threat to the book industry.
Yeah.
People often say, you know, if we didn't have libraries, there's no way they would let us invent them now.
No.
Just, it's so anathema to our capitalist sort of knowledge economy. They are almost like the last sort of failsafe of public access to information and knowledge and books. And so, you know, I think that's true. And that also is maybe why, in context, this sort of conflict and this sort of political dynamic is experienced by people on the ground, because there is a contradiction between the role of libraries in society and the way that our systems function outside of libraries, right? That are just our capitalist mode, the way that the information economy is expected to function. And so I think that is being experienced by libraries, kind of, that's the coalface, if you will, for access to knowledge and information in the modern era. And that's why it's so important to have people who are committed both to the mission of libraries and the public interest, and thinking and learning about copyright in a critical in a critical way. And that's why I think the work that you guys do is so important.
Absolutely. What we've been at pains to make clear is when we talk about copyright literacy, we're not talking about learning the rules of copyright so you can
better obey,
be a model consumer, better obey
the sheriff, like Eddie, also, the sheriff. Also, he's got a badge, our sheriff, hasn't he?
I mean, the whole point of it has to be critical, because otherwise, everything you've talked about, we just get stuck in reinforcing modes of inequality and power imbalance.
Yeah.
And libraries are there to allow us to find new knowledge and to question things. Mm-hmm. But one of the things we do see in the library sector is a real fear of legal action.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we want to avoid legal action. And clearly, yeah. I mean, people who have jobs like mine, to be the copyright specialist at a university and at a university library, you are, to a large extent, trying to avoid legal action. But at the same time, there has to be an acceptance that by taking a risk-managed approach to things, it's the only way you're ever going to be able to make your collections available. And in some cases, that means you might be subject to legal challenge. Clearly, in Canada, there has been very recent cases, your own institution in legal action with Access Canada. So can you tell us a bit about, not necessarily the detail of every, because I know it's quite involved, because there's been several cases, but just as a sense of how that's played out and how that has impacted on the research and education communities in Canada.
Yeah, no, there's so many different ways to approach answering this question, because it is such a big issue. And I was thinking, even when you were talking before about the role of librarians and the struggles they face, that you mentioned before, Jane, the paper that I wrote with Bob Tarantino about copyright in the times of COVID. And and we were thinking about educators and, you know, just the way that suddenly everything we were doing, because it was online, because it was recorded, because it was streamed, people were suddenly worried about copyright just in teaching their everyday classes the way they always would, right? And I was fielding questions, and I always do. I field questions from all my colleagues and from staff across the university. Like, is this okay? Is this okay? And the kinds of things that they were asking, like, you know, people were being advised just like strip all the images out your PowerPoint slides.
Yeah, yeah.
How does this even make sense? And people's willingness to do it, people who think critically about law in every other dimension were like, oh, we can't have images in our PowerPoint slides. I said, how? So I think, you know, that's one thing, and that's across the board. But the tie-in to the question that you asked me is just at my institution, at York University, how is this playing out, right? And the reality is that we've just been through virtually a decade, I guess, of litigation over our fair dealing policies and practices at York University. So, you know, it's everybody's nightmare scenario, right? Like, it's the thing that you're like, you know, because you've got higher educational institutions across the country decided to opt out. They all held hands and jumped out at the same time from the Access copyright licenses that were no longer feasible when they were being, you know, the cost was going to go up exponentially. The benefits had dropped significantly. So everybody, you know, after shifts in our fair dealing jurisprudence, a change in the way in which materials are being distributed, a change in the way in which libraries are licensing and accessing databases, everyone had a rethink and thought, you know, maybe it's not worth it for us to be paying Access copyright anymore. And so let's all do this together. And they did, but there's going to be litigation and someone's going to get sued. And of course, when, you know, and of course it was York University, we got sued. And it was really a trying time, because I remember nobody at the law faculty, this is quite common, I think, in universities, our opinions were not really solicited or necessarily welcomed by general counsel and by those who were actually engaged in the litigation. So a lot happened without anyone's involvement, and there was efforts made to sort of meet and advise people's names who might be familiar, at least to some, like Howard Knopf and Ariel Katz, whose work became absolutely vital in the end to the rulings before the courts, you know, reached out and said, you know, they don't have standing to sue. You could ask for this to be dismissed, or you need to say that the tariff isn't mandatory. And there wasn't an appetite to listen. There was just a kind of a fear and a responsiveness to the litigation that was like, okay, now we need to be gathering all the evidence we can, we need to play ball. And then we were stuck in this litigation for years and years. And all of the librarians were tasked with creating records and information about every copy that had been made for everyone, and all of that had to be provided. So it was resource intensive. And if you want to talk about copyright anxiety, trust me, it was there, you know. And whenever advice
was probably off the scale.
It was off the scale. It really was. Yeah, it was a lot. And so I think in the end, it all worked out very well, right? I won't, to your point, Chris, I won't give the whole development of the story, but the ending is a happy ending, right? Mm. Because we got to the Supreme Court and it was agreed that the universities don't have to pay the access copyright tariff, that it's not mandatory, that we can choose to or not. And if we don't, we could be vulnerable to a lawsuit for copyright infringement if there are infringing practices at the university. But the point that was being made is that actually we have fair dealing practices, and we spend, you know, huge amounts of money on transactional licensees and accessing material. We use open educational resources, we use open access resources, and basically you're not going to find much in the way of infringing material. And if someone does, they're welcome to sue, but it would need to be someone who actually has the copyright, which is not the Access Copyright Collective.
So I just wanted to pick up on something you said around the university's fair dealing policies, but also codes of best practice in so you've been involved in taking the codes of best practice in fair use in open educational resources, and then you've written an addendum to that piece, so the work of Peter Yarzi, and in this case Will Cross and Meredith Jacobs, and putting us the Canadian interpretation on that. And I believe as well there's work undergoing to actually create a standalone Canadian code for open educational resources. So can you tell us a bit about that project, but also just broadly, because you mentioned it in the lecture that you gave recently at the Nova University in Lisbon, around the value in having these codes created to help people make sense of the law.
Absolutely. So I think this is a really important avenue for us to pursue. We don't want to be fighting things through litigation. We certainly don't want to be defending our institutions in litigation. That's not a fun experience. What we want instead is to be able to have a culture where we respect copyright law, we understand how it works, and we can engage in education and research without unduly limiting ourselves because we're afraid of copyright litigation, because we experience this chill, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, that means, like, fortunately in Canada, we now have excellent jurisprudence on the scope of fair dealing rights for education, for private study, for research. We have a large and liberal interpretation of what these things are. And then we have a sort of multi-factor test for thinking about whether uses that we're making of protected material is fair. Mm. The factors will be familiar to most, I'm sure, but, you know, thinking about the purpose and the character of use, the amount that's being used. In Canada, we think about the alternatives to the use of the copyright work to achieve your purpose, thinking about the effect of the use on the market, thinking about the nature of the work that's being used. And then you sort of, you have to just work through these and make an assessment about whether a particular use is a fair use.
Yeah.
You know, if a use is a fair use for educational purposes, then it is a non-infringing use. And if it's a non-infringing use, that means you can do it. And you can do it on behalf of other people. You can do it on behalf of your library patrons. You can do it on behalf of your students. And no license fee is due for that use because it's not an infringing use. Mm. And so, you know, I was struck, I think Ariel Katz wrote a blog on this a while ago, saying, like, we have to be copyright grown-ups, right? We have to stop being children about this. Yeah. And the way to be grown-ups about it is to say, you know, like, you've been told these are the things you need to think about. And you're perfectly capable as any copyright lawyer or judge, of going through, knowing what you're doing and why you're doing it, and assessing whether it's fair.
Yeah.
Right? And just have at least the faith in yourself that you're not coming at this with ulterior motives. You're not coming at this trying to do something that's unfair or unlawful. Be a grown-up about it. Look through the factors, make an assessment about whether it's fair. And if it's fair, do it. Like, that's the exercise, your fair use rights, your fair dealing rights, do it. Because it's in the public interest, it's in the interest of the copyright system. And so trying to encourage people to go through that process is key, right? To having this whole system work the way it's supposed to. The idea about best practices is that, you know, people need to feel emboldened with their capacity to make that assessment. And when people are, you know, we talked at the very outset about legitimizing and mystifying force of law. People feel like, oh, I don't understand copyright law enough, or I don't know what I'm allowed to do, and I don't want to take any risks. And so they're unduly cautious.
Yeah.
And that is very harmful. And so I think arming people with information about how to conduct that assessment on a case-by-case basis, because that's what the law requires, is the key to ensuring that people have the confidence to actually exercise their fair dealing rights and to do their jobs well and properly and to facilitate access to educational materials. I don't know if that's, it feels like a long way down now, I'm sorry, Chris, but...
No, it's absolutely what... In fact, you saying that has... Something we came up recently, we were asked to do a set of copyright myths and facts.
Mm.
You do all the standard ones, does copyright protect ideas, myth, fact, and all that kind of stuff. But one of them I came up with is copyright, at its heart, has a series of really clear and easy rules if you just keep digging long enough. Which was probably a little bit weird.
It was a bit of a leading question, wasn't it?
But that's the issue, isn't it?
It is the issue.
That many people assume, and this is the kind of interactions we have all the time, that there is this simple to follow set of rules that maybe is sort of shrouded in all this detail, but it's there in the middle.
Somewhere underneath it all, it tells you that it's 10%.
Yeah, but the fact
or
is
that it's 5%. Or that it's many words from a poem.
And I think people who are in these sort of copyright advisory positions, particularly I was when I started out, you're looking for that because people are asking
you for it.
People are asking you for it. And then you go in and you say, well, I'll tell you what. And then you give them all this detail, all this huge amount of stuff that you've learned. But what you really need to do is boil down those principles.
Because
like you say, it's treating people like grown-ups, letting them make that decision.
I guess it's also the whole rules versus standards debate as well. And, you know, once you say to people there aren't any rules, it's getting them to recognise that that doesn't mean, oh, thus anything goes, does it?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, like that flexibility in the law is sort of by design,
right?
Like it's not a bug in the system.
No.
Like that's what it is. That's how it works. And that means that you have to make your assessment yourself about whether what you're doing is fair or not fair, or if it fits. This notion that people want certainty, I feel like predictability and certainty, I understand its appeal, but I think it's misplaced here. I don't think that we even want it.
No.
Right? Like, I think there's a risk in thinking that that's what we want, because one of the things actually that I think got York into trouble, and maybe one of the reasons why we were more vulnerable to that litigation, was that the Fair Dealing Guidelines, if I recall, did have something around the sort of rule of thumb, 10%.
Okay.
Or, you know, they had something that was, you know, you can do this, but not that. And the accusation was made, well, it's not necessarily the case that 10% is fair.
Mm.
And that's absolutely right. It's not necessarily the case. But it's not necessarily the case that 100% is unfair.
Yeah. Yeah.
Either, right? It cuts both ways. The point is that you can't have that bright line rule that can just be applied. What you have is a standard. What you have is a contextualized multi-factor assessment that you have to do on the ground, right? And I think if we were to accept that that's the process, then what I love about the CCH case in Canada, the argument had been made, well, you know, it's a case-by-case assessment. So at the Federal Court of Appeal, they're like, you know, it looks fair to us, but we couldn't possibly say that everything they're doing is fair because it's, you know, case-by-case.
Right.
So go away, negotiate on that basis. But then the Supreme Court said, we can actually say that because we're looking at a practice. And the practice is a fair practice. Mm. People, like the guidelines are there. The access to law policy, which was the applicable one in that case, says what's permitted and what's not and what's fair. And it asks researchers to identify what they're doing. This practice is a fair practice. Mm. And it facilitates research and private study. And therefore, they are engaged in fair dealing.
Mm.
So I think that that helps, and I like that. But I think thinking about how we can instantiate that practice, how we can encourage and arm people on the front lines to make those assessments. That's key, and that's where the best practices guys come in. And Peter Yazzie has done tons of work on this with Patricia Afterhide over the years, and really trying to sort of arm people with their fair use rights.
Yeah.
And in different industries, different creative communities, but I think for open educational resources, this is key, because one thing that we know now is that we need to get out from under the thumb of some of the traditional publishers in this space, because it's becoming unsustainable, unaffordable, and unnecessary, right? And we have people who want to create their own educational materials, who want to use those to educate their students, to improve them year upon year, to share them with other people teaching the same courses. And there's no good reason why we're not doing this.
Yeah.
And copyright is certainly not a good reason why we're not doing this.
Absolutely. And I think what we've got here is a real need to move these out of just a US-specific context and look at them globally. And I know that the work that you've been doing and how Peter was describing it is sort of moving towards a more global definition of what is fair and fair practice.
Well, I suppose the thing as well with open educational resources is they're open. So by their very nature, they're global.
And that was the conversation we were having around, and there was an event recently talking about open access monographs and what we're going to do in the UK, what the policy is going to be around the requirement to have them Creative Commons licensed if they've got third-party content in it. I think we need to really stand up for the principle, the paradigm that actually open means open, it's global, and fairness is fair. It's a tough argument to make because of the nature of copyright being different in different countries, but it's an important part of it.
Speaking of different countries, though, there's been some developments in Canada very recently around the term extension of copyright, which... you're pulling a little bit of a face. No, it was always one of those things, you know, you look at works coming into the public domain and 70 years, is this author in copyright, out of copyright now? And then, oh no, we've got to look at Canada as well, because it was 50 years, which actually lots of the evidence we see shows that longer copyright terms are not necessarily beneficial at all. But you've gone from 50, haven't you, to 70 very recently. Mm-hmm. So could you comment on some of the kind of reactions to that in the education community in Canada? What's the feeling been?
Yeah, I mean, I can comment on my reaction. And when I think about other people's reaction, I think that it was received mostly as being inevitable.
Right.
Amongst the library community and educational community, but not by everybody, by any stretch. But, you know, there was a sense that that's what it is everywhere else. Mm. Like, we can only be, you know, standing out on our own for so long. We usually go either with Europe or the UK or America, but it's rare that we do something completely unto ourselves. And so I think there was a sense that it was futile to expect anything else. But I also, for my own part, and those of us who made submissions to the government and argued for a different approach to this, it was really disappointing, because there are a few instances where Canada has gone its own way. We have, for example, a user-generated content exception, like the YouTube exception for non-commercial creative reuses, that no one else quite has, but is really, I think, called for in this day and age. Whether you can get the benefit of it with all of the US takedown notices, you can't really. But still, you know, it says something that we have it. We have a notice and notice regime instead of a notice and takedown regime, so that we don't actually expect intermediaries or ISPs to be taking down unlawful content or taking down content when they're notified by a copyright owner that it's infringing. So there are a couple of places where we've really sort of held the line that I think are important. And one of those had been copyright term. And the copyright term was, in a way, the easiest place to justify holding the line, because there is just no justification for a copyright term of life plus 70 years.
No,
I mean, people almost don't even pretend anymore that there is a justification, except that, you know, for those people whose works are still valuable at that time, they like to be able to command a profit for them. Mm. And that's, like, mostly Disney. But if you actually look at copyright policy, unless you're committed to the notion that the rights should be perpetual, then there's just no good economic or policy reason to say there should be 70 years as opposed to 50. Mm. We had argued here that we could extend, because it turned out Canada kind of had to do this in the context of CUSMA or the US MCA, depending on where you are, but our sort of NAFTA 2 negotiations. It was a concession that Canada ended up making in order to get presumably some other kind of leverage somewhere else in the trade agreement.
Yeah. Yeah.
So in that sense, it was inevitable.
Beef. We heard it was about beef.
I've heard cheese, milk, beef, and lumber.
Really?
I don't know if that's
not maple syrup.
No, no, because the Americans like crappy maple syrup. They don't like the Canadian stuff anyway. Yeah. But no, I would.
We'll pick up on maple syrup.
Yeah,
again.
You want Canadian maple syrup. And I think auto. We could add in auto manufacturing in there somewhere as well. No one quite knows, of course, what it was that was given for what. These are all sort of negotiations around the table. But that was a card that I guess Canada thought it had to play. Like, we could go up these 20 years, but hopefully we got something for it. And maybe, you know, if we believe in the process, it was worth it. Who knows? I very much doubt it. But from a copyright policy perspective, it's not worth anything. Like, it's just a disaster. Right. Like, it just comes with public costs, more limitations, and no benefits at all to be shown for it. Right, we're not getting any more works because of the extension of the duration. We're not creating any incentives in retrospect for things to be created, and nobody who's about to create something decides not to bother because it's going to expire 50 years after their death rather than 70. Like, there's just no actual public benefit here at all. And so we had argued that we need to sort of limit that extension by applying formalities to it, by requiring a registration for the last 20 years. And we thought that internationally that was permitted because the rule against formalities is in the Berne Convention, and that's for life plus 50. So we're like, okay, formalities after, for the last 20 years, would mean only the people for whom it's worth registering and paying to register would register. And then we would know who those people are. So we would minimise the orphan works problem as well. And we would prevent just everything from being sucked up by this additional 20 years.
Yeah.
And so we had really compelling evidence about the benefits that this would bring. We had really compelling arguments, I think, about why that was the appropriate response. The government was interesting. They were listening. People testified about it. They asked questions about it. And then in the end, they just shoved this 20-year extension at the back of the budget bill and passed it with no discussion at all. And so that was the thing that was just so disheartening, I think, about the whole process, because it was really a missed opportunity to show how we can address this term extension problem and how other jurisdictions could have approached it and the difference that formalities would have made. You know, missed opportunity, a bit disappointing.
And at the Create event as well, which was all about copyright evidence, you raised it actually as part of that discussion. I don't think you were exactly saying, what's the point of gathering any empirical data or evidence around copyright because everyone ignores it? But it's clearly, I suppose, it's always been a part of copyright history, though. I mean, if you go back, and I'm thinking about the lectures I went to about copyright history and about the Berne Convention and what happened at the time, even in its very inception, these were trade-offs from one country and another, and Britain nearly didn't join, and the last minute they said, okay, actually it's probably in our best interest. That's the way that international politics kind of works.
Well, that's it. I mean, and this again, it goes back to the critical legal stance, right? Like, if the whole thing's politics, then this whole notion of sort of evidence-based policy making is probably a little unrealistic. I mean, when has copyright ever been evidence-based? You know, like, we've happily told ourselves stories about incentives for a long time now, but there's really nothing particularly compelling in the way of evidence to show that those incentives actually do what we say that they do.
No.
And so, you know, it just doesn't feel like it's ever been evidence-based. And to imagine that it is, I think the risk is that you miss the politics, that you miss the power play, that you actually are taking it on face value, that the arguments that we use to justify it might in fact justify it. Like, I just don't think that they do or they ever did. However, you're right, Chris, I'm not trying to say evidence gathering is a pointless exercise, because one of the things that you get to do is to say, oh, you say that the evidence shows that this creates an incentive, that creates ultimately a public benefit, and so we're going to do this evidence gathering for you, And then we're going to pinpoint where you don't have the evidence that supports the system that we have. Or we're going to provide you with evidence that shows that we could do things differently and that would be better. And at least it kind of forces the hand, right? If nothing else, it forces them to reveal the hand, which is to say, oh, actually, we don't care.
Yeah.
And so what's disappointing about the Canadian example for the copyright term extension is that we had this very nice Copyright Act review process leading up to the report in 2019 of the INDU committee, where the committee was asking for more evidence and was refusing to move, like, for example, to follow the EU on the upload filter, Article 17, like refusing to do that because they didn't have the evidence and they wanted to wait and see what the evidence showed about how that worked and how it was implemented. And it looked like the government was saying, from now on, we're not going to be responding to every sort of lobbyist that comes asking for more. We're going to want to see the evidence that this is going to bring some benefit for us. And so that was a welcome shift in copyright policy making. It showed a more consultative process and ultimately, hopefully, a more evidence-based process. And so the reason I guess it's disappointing, of course, is it turned out the evidence didn't matter.
Yeah.
For me, I think that's important because it reveals, you know, that in fact, the arguments that are made in support of it are not compelling.
Yeah.
And so it brings politics back into the picture. Now, if you're really committed to economics and evidence, then Paul Heald responded, I think, to my question at Create, oh, well, maybe that gave them the sum of money that they were able to to basically put on the table and work out what was commensurate in their negotiations over the treaty. So we can't track it. But, you know, he liked to believe it still mattered. And God love him, I hope he's right. I just don't necessarily think that that's it. And it's very, very hard to put a number value on the cost of exclusion, right? The cost of what people can't do and who's not doing stuff. Like, that's not necessarily something we can have or gather evidence to show, but it's something we feel and something we experience and something that's real. And so similarly to me saying, you know, I don't need evidence to say that women are disproportionately disadvantaged in a copyright system. Mm. I don't need evidence to know that copyright doesn't work the way that we say it does. Like, I think we experience that every day. But I think having more evidence to prove that or to show where the arguments are weak or where they fail in favour of strong copyright, that's worth doing.
Yeah, absolutely. More research.
Research is needed.
More research is needed, but more research is never a bad thing.
No, absolutely. Right. So I know we've got limited time
left.
One thing we would definitely like to ask you about, you're synonymous with Canada because you've been there for such a long time and are sort of part of that system. But when you were in Glasgow, we could definitely tell your Scottish roots there as you made a beeline for the Tunnock's tea cakes in the Iron Brew.
I had to get back to my mum's house for a Tunnock's tea.
But we always,
Paris.
Someone was hiding them.
We like to ask what our guest's favourite cake or sweet treat is.
So yes,
is
we've been tucking into mince pies, haven't we?
We are recording this in the run up to Christmas 2022. By the time it comes out, it might be Christmas 2023.
Who knows?
But yes, is there something particularly that will always get you going? Oh,
you're settling down with your favourite tome on copyright law.
Mm-hmm.
You need something sweet to keep you going. What's it going to be, Karis?
Well, so we've established that Tunnock's tea cakes are high on my list, but we don't know. We don't know if they really qualify as a cake. I mean, maybe in the name we could give them that, but
are they a biscuit? Are they?
Or putting them aside, and even then, like,
or is it like a sweet? Because it's got marshmallow in it. Yeah, so that pudding, we're putting that aside.
Pure marshmallow and chocolate. Yeah, so putting that aside, and then the caramel wafers, which come along with those. My grands were both fantastic bakers, and my gran used to sort of famously wheel out her little tray of baked goods whenever you visited her. And so I'm just like trying to picture what was on that tray. And there was always some shortbread and some caramel shortbread and some treacle sponge, which was very good. Some gingerbread thickly spread with butter. Very good. But it was her scones that were just the absolute best. So again, not sure a scone is a cake, but that would be my thing. A scone, like, thickly spread with salty butter and homemade jam from my gran's tea tray.
Your gran's tea tray sounds amazing.
Oh, It was.
It does.
It's just conjured up such an image of, you know, a cake buffet.
A groaning platter.
Yes. She didn't have a trolley, though, did she? She didn't actually...
It did have some wheels.
Oh, it did have wheels.
There was an order in which you had to approach it. So you had to start with the shortbread, and then you could work your way to the scones, and then at the bottom was always a lemon sponge cake, and that was what you had at the end. It was fantastic.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. By which time your arteries were groaning.
It's kind of rolling out of there at the end of the day.
On a sugar high. Yeah. Oh, Caris, that's fantastic. It that's made me hungry now as well.
Delicious, yeah.
Yeah, no, yeah, yeah. No. I think we were aware we have taken up
the full amount, the full of, amount of time.
I think we've got a minute left. You've got to go.
That was
thank you
really
for your
fantastic.
Time. Really, yeah, we really enjoyed it. Have a lovely day.
Thank you. You too. Same to you.
Bye.
And so our podcast has come to its end. And we know you have to go. You only set aside an hour for this, but there's one more gift we'd like to bestow. One last thing.
Only one last thing.
There's been some nerdy chat. You've had enough of that, but one last thing.
Only one last thing.
We stay around for one last thing. One last thing.
Hello, how are you doing?
Very well. Hi. How are you? Hi.
Very good. We're great.
It has been a while, hasn't it?
Yes. I know. I was thinking about it when I was listening again to the recording.
Because it actually has been over a year. I think it was December 2022 when we spoke
actually.
To you.
I think it was, actually. Yeah.
If you remember, actually, the conversation. Now, we didn't share this with you before. Let us.
If we were to create a musical commemoration of our conversation, is there a particular style that you would associate yourself with?
A particular style
of music.
What kind of musical style?
I feel like it would have to be something Scottish in the end. Maybe a bit of Paolo Nutini or something. Could you do that?
Oh, okay. You've got a challenge there.
Do you know Paolo Nutini? You know, like I put some new shoes on and everything's going to be all right.
You could probably work with that.
All right, we can have a think about that.
Well, actually, I managed to get through some connections. Actually, get Paolo himself to record you this song. So interesting to see what you think of what he's managed to come up with.
And he's also been busy. That is actually part of what the
delay's
been.
And also whether or not
he's been on tour, hasn't he?
Whether or not his Scottish accent seems to have sort of slipped into some sort of strange, weird version, as if it was done by a sort of not particularly well-accented English person. Anyway, let's see what you think of this.
All right, let's hear it.
We were wondering who we would talk to next on the podcast that we run. We needed somebody with style and class, not just anyone. Then we went to Glasgow at the ARC, where the Create folks were having a do. When we saw her in the flesh for the very first time, we knew what we had to do. So if you want to know more than you did before about critical approaches to copyright law, then let's spend some time with someone really cool who likes tonics, tea cakes and iron brew. Yes, it's Caris Craig from Osgoode Hall, a vet from the Canadian copyright wars, with her best pal Brody by her side. We got 60 awesome minutes of
I love love it.
Gonna say, what can you say to that?
That is just mind blowing. You've done very well. That's going to be my anthem for life now.
Absolutely.
That will be like the walk up song that I'll play when I'm stepping up to the microphone at conferences and so on. You need a walk up song. That will be it.
You do. You do. And we will send that to you. Yeah, that's our absolutely. Gift to you. So say thank you. And apologies for taking so long to get this podcast out there, but we think it was well worth the wait, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It just gets better with time.
There we go. Like a fine wine.
Or a cheese.
And like all of us.
Or cheese and wine.
Or cheese and wine, yes.
Oh, hang on, there's a cat. We've got...
good. Good, because Brody has abandoned me.
Oh, did you notice he features in the song?
I did, I appreciate that.
Yeah.
He'll be very grateful for the mention.
So, yeah, we were interested to know if there's been any updates on any of the things that we spoke about when we spoke back in December 22.
All right, so yeah, I have a couple of things probably worth bringing to your listeners' attention. So the first thing that hasn't happened, of course, is anything going into the public domain in Canada. We talked about the Canada copyright term extension. Mm. So that's the thing. We're not going to see anything new in the public domain till 2043. The other thing is worth noting, we've had a couple of consultations now on AI, of course, and copyright. And so what we're seeing is that the publishers and the copyright collectives are beginning to circle around and smell blood in the water, thinking they might have another basis to claim some sort of payout from AI. So there's a lot of work going on that front. Everyone wants a piece of the AI pie.
Oh, yes.
But so far, nothing much has happened, so we'll see. The other thing I wanted to mention was that I think we spoke about the Fair Dealing for Open Educational Resources and Fair Use. There was a best practices guide that was coming out of the folks at PGIP in Washington. And so I had contributed an addendum to that about the Canadian Fair Dealing and Open Educational Resources. Now there's a whole version that's been released by the Canadian Association of Research Libraries that's specifically on fair dealing and open educational resources in Canada and best practices for that. So if we could link to that for the listeners, I think that would be really helpful. And then finally, just to let you know, there's been some ongoing litigation with Access Copyright, and they continue to lose all of their cases in Canada. So I think that's also a good news story. And the federal government has not done any backtracking in the most recent budget to undo any of the new rules on fair dealing. So they're resisting the cries of the publishers and the collectives who are lobbying for rewinding fair dealing for education. So I think all of that is pretty good, apart from the whole, you know, copyright term extension, which will continue to be bad.
Brilliant. Well, thank you for giving us the update.
Absolutely.
And as our listeners listen through the rest of the interview that you did with us, where you go through all of those and explain really clearly and beautifully all those things and how they've been developing. Yeah, good to have an update. So thank you.
Oh, it's always so fun to chat with you. Thank you so much for having me on.
Copyright Waffle. All right.